You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Okay, so most of us need to have great ideas consistently in order to succeed in our job. But where do great ideas come from? And how can you increase your chances of having that great idea right when you need it? I'm Todd Henry, best-selling author and host of the Accidental Creative Podcast. Join me for a weekly conversation with brilliant creative professionals, authors, and leaders about how to thrive in today's marketplace. We discuss everything from managing time and reclaiming focus to discovering what really fuels your best work. Each week, you'll discover how to be prolific, brilliant, and healthy in life and in work. So if you find that you also need a great idea at a moment's notice from time to time, follow The Accidental Creative wherever you listen to podcasts. You'll discover all the strategies you need to be brilliant when it matters most. That's The Accidental Creative wherever you listen to podcasts.
Curious about the nuts and bolts of the stock market? It's not just for finance types anymore. Take it from a couple of regular guys, Dave and Andrew, who taught themselves about investing and teach it all on the Investing for Beginners podcast. Start with their Back to Basics series on episode 43 and use that knowledge to design your better financial future today.
0900 hours, Thursday, July 25th, 2019. President Trump called Ukraine's President Zelensky supposedly to congratulate him on his recent victory. In the months that followed, the American public would only learn what happened on that call because Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman felt duty-bound to report it up the chain of command that the President of the United States had extorted a foreign ally to damage a political challenger at home. Vindman's actions and subsequent testimony before Congress would lead to Trump's impeachment and affirm Vindman's belief that he had done the right thing in the face of intense pressure to stay silent. But it would come at an enormous cost, straining relationships with colleagues, superiors, and even his own father, and eventually end his decorated career in the U.S. Army by a Trump administration intent on retribution. Now, for the first time, Vindman offers a full account of his experience in a new book titled Here, Right Matters, An American Story. And today, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman joins me on the podcast to talk about that fateful phone call and why he got a sense that something was fishy even before the call was placed. He reveals that he instantly knew he had to report Trump's abuse of power even before the call ended, how his Army training came in handy when he testified in the congressional impeachment hearing, and how a pressure campaign from the White House robbed him of his expected military promotion. Plus, how he handles Twitter trolls, and how he's showing his solidarity with other heroes who have run afoul of Donald Trump's angry mob. Coming up with Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman in just a moment. Alexander Vindman was most recently the director of Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Russia on the White House's National Security Council. He served as a foreign area officer with assignments in Moscow and for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as a political military affairs officer. He is currently a doctoral student at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, senior fellow at the Lawfare Institute, and a visiting fellow at Perry World House. He is, however, best known as the whistleblower who exposed President Donald Trump's infamous July 25, 2019 phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, which led to the second impeachment of Donald Trump. It culminated in Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's dramatic testimony before the House Impeachment Committee, in which he famously said, "Here, right matters." Indeed, that's the title of his new memoir, Here, Right Matters, An American Story. Alexander Vindman, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Ben. I'm looking forward to being on Kick-Ass News with you.
It's a pleasure. We are now little more than 2 years since the infamous July 25th phone call between Donald Trump and the Ukrainian president and the impeachment proceedings that, of course, followed. Has your life finally gotten back to some semblance of normality by now?
Not any semblance of normality as I knew it. My 20-year military career was guided by a laser focus on public service and on keen focus on national security issues, foreign policy. My only real considerations were I never had to consider where my paycheck was coming from, the medical care. I had to maybe think about the next move in terms of military assignments. That's all kind of gone by the wayside now. And I'm involved in a bunch of really interesting things, working on a doctorate, senior fellow at the Lawfare Institute on the board of a non-governmental organization. But it's a kind of a brave new world trying to figure out what I want to do and really kind of, dealing with the after effects of doing my duty, seeking to defend U.S. national security interests. In my case, really against the president of the United States, I was looking to undermine the very kind of foundations of good governance and free and fair elections. So not quite back to normal yet. I'm not sure what normal is going to look like from here on out, but I'm working hard to kind of provide some security and stability for my family and figure out what I want to do in the long run.
You, of course, left the White House when Trump was surrounded by a scandal, and you came in when he was surrounded by a scandal. It's kind of interesting. Your first day at the NSC was the very same day in 2018 when President Trump met with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, and he famously told a press conference that he trusted Putin as much as his own intelligence community when it came to the 2016 election. That was about a year before the Ukraine call. So I have to wonder, what was your overall impression of Donald Trump in the year or so prior to that infamous phone call?
You know, it's interesting. I think it's a feature of Donald Trump that he's as destructive to himself and his own interests as he is to the country, frankly, oftentimes. Unfortunately, he's terribly destructive on both accounts. At the time, before I had come to the NSC, I had done my due diligence. I had kind of understood that I was coming into a perilous environment that didn't operate the way previous administrations did, but I still saw an opportunity to do some good and advance U.S. national security interests. The reason I was offered the position is because I drafted the key documents for the Department of Defense on how we face Russia as an adversary. And I thought I could do the same thing, kind of just magnify it and elevate it to the national level. I had reason to believe that I could be successful because Fiona Hill was on the team and she was like-minded and a student of Russia and President Putin. And that first day I learned that I was going to have some major, major headwinds. But I also recognized that Donald Trump had little to no interest in foreign policy. He was highly transactional. He would only kind of, step into foreign policy where he saw a transactional benefit, either with kind of rousing a constituency or for personal gain, which happened quite often, unfortunately. And he didn't really pay that close attention to Russia or really the rest of my portfolio, Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus, or the Caucasus. He didn't care. He didn't understand what the value is of those regions were to U.S. national security interests. So I thought I could still do a lot of good, frankly. I just knew that there would be breaks on being able to really implement a Russia strategy that would help the U.S. the way I thought we needed to do it.
Well, I want to go ahead and just skip straight to that fateful day, July 25th, 2019. Prior to the phone call, did you have any sense that something was a little bit off about that situation between the White House and Ukraine, or that this was not going to be a normal phone call between two world leaders?
I was of two minds. I was both very apprehensive and also maybe naively optimistic. What I certainly had watched unfold over the preceding months was a foreign policy being run outside of U.S. government channels. Rudy Giuliani first kind of trashing Ambassador Yovanovitch, both directly and indirectly, and then Don Jr., you know, who had zero clue about what was going on in the region, or you know, probably any at large, really, frankly, you know, trashing Ambassador Yovanovitch, a career public servant, and then those things unfolding over the preceding months that were alarming me, but I, in a way, disaggregated them from the president directly, because I thought that these were people looking to curry favor, ingratiate themselves with the president, you know, do the president's bidding, and somewhat blindly, my off of the office of the president kind of didn't allow me to really, even though I had seen really bad, you know, the double dealing from the president, I didn't really believe that the president was going to attack the very foundations of our democracy and electoral process. So I thought that, you know, we put together a call on its merits. The president had already executed one phone call with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. I thought, you know, if it went anything like that, we could actually make some headway on normalizing the relationship, providing Ukraine the kind of support they needed to face Russian aggression. And in the days right before the call was initially on the schedule, it was pulled off because Ambassador Bolton, the national security advisor at the time, killed it, thought there was too much danger, and then it went back on. I was, you know, kind of perplexed as to why all this was going on just from a scheduling standpoint. And it landed, I just did what I thought was right. I provide the president kind of a script to follow, much like he had done the first time around. And
you wrote the talking points for him, correct?
Yes. Yes. Like I had done previously, I'd written the president's talking points. I'd written the background papers. I had illuminated why this is such an important relationship for the United States, primarily because Ukraine in the Western orbit and out of the Russian camp, which is where they want to be. That's not where we're pushing them. That's where they want to be naturally, is much more enhancing of U.S. national security. There's a famous line by Zbigniew Brzezinski, the national security advisor for Jimmy Carter, in which he states, it should not be underestimated that Russia, absent Ukraine, ceases to become an empire, but Ukraine, subordinated and suborned by Russia, automatically becomes an empire. And, you know, a Russia that's already challenging U.S. interests, it would just be magnified as a threat.
It's an interesting situation because, I mean, it seems like the president at the time was already predisposed not to help Ukraine just by virtue of his reverence for Vladimir Putin and his strange relationship with Russia. And then it seems like he, I guess, had some kind of self-interested motive to actually bolster that. So in his mind, I guess there were plenty of reasons for him not to do anything for Ukraine. And I'm curious, it's interesting that the national security advisor, John Bolton, was conspicuously absent from that phone call. Was that a tip off to you? And I wonder, do you think that he should have been if he knew that something was amiss here?
You know, you're really, you're the first person that asked that question and note that. So I applaud that. He should have been part of that phone call. He would have under every single normal circumstance, he would be part of the phone call. He was conspicuously absent from the phone call because he didn't want to be party to what he had, you know, weeks before called a drug deal, sensing that, you know, the president was going to demand an investigation into a political opponent. And he didn't want to be there in a position to have to testify.
I mean, I don't want to throw you under the bus with Bolton here, but do you feel that knowing what he knew, that, you know, maybe if you had been in his position, you would have wanted to have been in that meeting to cut the phone cord if you had to, or do whatever you had to stop?
You know, it's funny. Fiona Hill in that Helsinki press conference joked about like fainting to just kind of upset the whole thing, you know, just kind of pull the plug on it. And, you know, you would hope that senior leaders in the Pentagon to kind of defend U.S. national security, not in the Pentagon, in the White House, would, you know, do the same thing, jump on the grenade to defend U.S. national security interests. I think that Bolton had a clear understanding based on his direct interactions with the president, with Mick Mulvaney, with the senior most leadership, that the president was potentially going to do this and didn't want to be in a position where he would put his kind of his own political life on the line and have to be in that type of situation. The thing is that, you know, Bolton's never, he's given his account, obviously, in his book, but he's never really given a full accounting of the president and the presidential misdeeds. You know, if there was an effort to hold the Trump administration accountable, there'd be an effort to kind of probably depose Bolton on all the wrongdoing that he witnessed firsthand, which is probably, well, absolutely much broader in scope. And in reading the book, you sense that I kind of have some admiration for John Bolton, maybe not from the policy standpoint, which I didn't necessarily agree with him on a lot of his policy, but on his kind of just cold competence and a savvy kind of political maneuvering. The same way I in certain ways, briefly remarked on Radcliffe's Representative Radcliffe's questioning that, you know, is kind of like a capable adversary or something of that nature.
Now, as you listened on that call, what were the exact words out of Trump's mouth that were the big red flag for you? Or when did you get a sense, okay, this is really something serious, and I need to be listening very hard and taking good notes here?
Yeah, I mean, so the good thing is that, like, I'd done these phone calls, and I had my government green notebook and was taking copious notes throughout the whole time. But I knew immediately when the president got on the line, just the tone suggested that it started out with a clarity that the phone call was not going to deliver on, improving the relationship with Ukraine, indicating that, you know, Ukraine has got U.S. support, even though the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, defense, everybody was on the same page and kind of offering encouragement to Ukraine as they're waging a war, Russia was waging a war against Ukraine. The president was not on the same page. The president was the only one that, you know, was acting purely on self-interest rather than national security interest. So the tone alarmed me, but as the conversation proceeded and the president kind of, you know, berated Zelensky for Ukraine not being grateful enough for all the support the U.S. gave Ukraine, and Zelensky saying, you know, basically being charismatic and engaging with Trump, trying to kind of win him over like you do, like a comedian would do with like an unfriendly crowd, and ultimately saying, well, we actually want to do business with you, pandering to the president's interest for transactional benefit. We'll buy your javelins. We'll give you money. We'll buy your javelins, anti-tank missiles. And the president immediately launching into, I need you to do us a favor, though. That was the tipping point. And then, you know, the president kind of going into his rant about Joe Biden's wrongdoing, which is completely, it's a mirage. There's no credible kind of evidence to suggest that. And something I've done extensive due diligence on. And the president basically directing both the Attorney General and Giuliani to engage Zelensky and his administration to conduct an investigation into the Bidens, so he could harm his principal opponent going into 2020. And this was the beginning of a continuing enterprise to try to steal the election that we saw play out all the way through January 6th. And the line that we've now kind of heard him say to the Department of Justice, just launch an investigation. I'll take care of it from there.
Now, I should point out that you were not in the Oval Office with him during this call. You were actually in one of the Situation Rooms with the other NSC officials. A lot of people don't realize that there's kind of the famous Situation Room that we see in photos, and then there's these other smaller conference rooms down there. As you sat there with your colleagues, did you see any of them flinch or wince or exchange glances when Trump blatantly solicited an investigation into Biden?
You're right. There are two conference rooms in the West Wing. There's the Kennedy Situation Room, the big one that's on TV sometimes. And there's a small one that people actually have seen also when the Osama bin Laden raid was occurring. President Obama and Hillary Clinton were sitting in that smaller room. And, so it's a pretty intimate set of quarters. There were only a handful. There were only a handful of folks that were in the room. And I saw, you know, people react to this. But I really didn't pay that close attention to what they did. I just kind of like took a quick look around, surveyed what was going on, and then really went back to the business of taking my notes and thinking through, you know, damage control. What does this mean for our bilateral relationship? What does this mean for U.S. national security? And, you know, already knowing that I was going to report this because this was an attack on free and fair elections, kind of the fundamental building block for our democracy. And I knew it was my responsibility, fell on my shoulders to do something about it. I didn't really carefully weigh with whether I was going to have support from other people because it was squarely in my portfolio as the director for Eastern Europe, the director for Ukraine, and it was my responsibility to take action.
So you knew then and there that you had to report this. This wasn't some, you know, painful process that you went through, sleepless nights and all that.
Immediately. I mean, in a lot of ways, it was a far easier decision because it was all in-house, all within classified channels, all with the aim of, you know, leveraging the organizational structure of the National Security Council, the senior most attorney, John Eisenberg, that had direct access to the president, that could counsel the president on what he was doing, being at minimum awful, but likely unlawful also, and an abuse of power, and getting the president to reverse course. And what most people don't understand is that this president constantly reversed course on ill-considered tweets. You know, he has this kind of bravado publicly, but behind the scenes, he would like flip-flop back and forward on stuff and be highly indecisive and you know, have to backpedal on ill-considered ideas. Fortunately, you know, he backpedaled on nuking hurricanes and stuff like that. So, you know, they say that the president has unchecked authority. Yes, you're right. The president, I guess, is responsible for foreign policy. But at the same time, it's good that there are people to check him on that, because otherwise we'd be nuking hurricanes left and right. So
now the person that you reported to, of all people, was actually your own brother. That must have been a very awkward conversation. I mean, how did he react?
Not the least bit awkward, actually. I mean, my twin brother, you know, he's the closest person I have besides my wife and my daughter. This is the first time we're stationed together, but we are very, very close. And I reported to him what I witnessed rather than made the official report as the reporting officer on wrongdoing. And the reason that that's an important clarification is that I'm not trying to kind of diminish his role, but I had previously reported my concerns to John Eisenberg. That's where I was going back. The reason I wanted to talk to my brother is both because he was the ethics official, but also because I wanted him as a witness to my official report through the chain of command. So like this, there would not be like a he said, she said type of thing where I would have an uncorroborated report or something like that. So, and I, you know, he's my twin brother. So I could take every bit of liberty. You could see that in the book, you know, where like we're walking down the halls, I quickly glance around, I might punch him or something like that just for fun. But in this case, I walked in there, you know, dead serious, his office is right across from mine. And I, you know, walked in, closed the door, and I told him, you know, did a bit of a dramatic pause. I made sure I had his attention. I said, Eugene, if what I'm about to tell you ever becomes public, the president will be impeached. And it was just a cold assessment of the gravity of the moment, a cold assessment of the assault on our democracy and of, you know, a violation of the Constitution, without necessarily realizing all the repercussions, you know, the fact that, you know, the president, that this would become public, the fact that this would have to play out through congressional action, the fact that this would ultimately cost my career. I just knew exactly what I had to do, and I was not going to be deterred from doing it.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more when we return in just a minute.
Welcome to the Wild Black Podcast, a safe space designed by us and especially for us. Wild Black is here for all the moments. The times you want to scream, we get it. So we'll scream right along with you. The times you just need someone to say it plain and make it make sense. So we bring on expert guests who care enough to do just that. The moment you need to laugh. Why does grandma have plastic on the couch? And who are these people that put sugar in their grits? Not me. Wild Black has you covered. In the moments where you need inspiration or motivation, our dope quote leans against words from our past to inform our future. Wild Black is here to help you, entertain you, inform you, inspire you, and simply make you better. While Black is freedom, do yourself a favor and ride with us anywhere you listen to podcasts. Now go hit that play button.
American history is full of infamous people, places, and events. If you've ever wanted to know the true story of the Salem witch trials or the 1919 World Series baseball scandal, known as the Black Sox scandal, or hear about the masterful escape attempts from Alcatraz prison or the mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle, or hear the crazy details of gangsters, assassins, and thieves like D.B. Cooper, Bonnie and Clyde, John Dillinger, John Wilkes Booth, and Lee Harvey Oswald, join me on the Infamous America podcast. I'm your host, Chris Wimmer, and on this podcast, you'll get the in-depth, true stories of some of the darker and more controversial chapters of American history. The stories are all told with cinematic music and sound design, and there are already more than 100 episodes waiting for you to binge. Subscribe or follow the Infamous America podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, Amazon Music, or wherever you're listening now.
And the pressure campaign ramped up almost immediately from what it sounds like in your book. What kind of pressure were you getting from the president, his allies, all the people up the chain from you?
Sure. So, I mean, immediately there was this, when this became, even before this became public, frankly, I was already being kind of ostracized, and the scope of my duties were being limited. There were a number of trips that I had taken with, in a previous iteration with Ambassador Bolton, that I wasn't the National Security Advisor, that I didn't take in this one subsequently to this, to my report to three countries that were in my portfolio. So I knew I was on the outs a little bit, but that was something I could still live with because I could still be functional. There's a little bit of a kind of like pride of going on these trips because you're getting to represent the country, but I could still do all the things behind the scenes I was doing. But when this became public, that's when I really became targeted, and the president's White House, the president's press team sent out a series of attack talking points, ham-handedly sending them not just to Fox News and Laura Ingraham, but to media that wasn't partisan and wasn't friendly. And I remember an article in which the Daily Beast got a hold of this thing, actually the talking points with letterhead and stuff like that, and said that laid out exactly the attack vectors, dual alliances, leaker, bad judgment, the stuff that would continue to reverberate through through the president's proxies from there on. And then the military was weak-kneed in response to this assault on me, and I couldn't defend myself. So I basically was just taken incoming without having anybody to support me from my department and the military, because they thought it was okay to kind of let me take it. And I don't know what they were thinking.
You were actually in line for promotions to colonel and other important military honors, but that mysteriously stalled, not just impacting you, but many other officers who were up for promotion. I'm curious, what was your understanding of the machinations at play behind the scenes there? And do you feel like the military failed you?
I don't have full situational awareness, but I have pretty darn good clarity. I know that there was a, besides the public campaign, there was a campaign to block my promotion. There was a memorandum that was circulated that was completely fraudulent about like wrongdoing I had that was supposed to instigate an investigation into me, which the Army assured me wasn't going to happen, but actually ultimately did happen. The president's chief of staff hauled in the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of the Army, berated them for considering putting my name on the list. This promotion list was delayed for months, and many folks were affected. It wasn't just the people that were on the list that were trying to figure out, what their next move was. It's also the hundreds more that weren't getting the promotion and wanted to know whether they still had a military career, whether they needed to start considering retirement. So it was pretty clear to me, between that and the conversations I had with seniors that had told me that I could no longer serve as a foreign area officer, that I wouldn't be able to serve in any place that's really significant anymore. I could collect a paycheck really and kind of just have a cushy job. And another senior general that told me that I had flown too close to the sun. I certainly had pissed off, military officers. I knew I was done. And then in the middle of a pandemic, I basically submitted my retirement with some confidence in the fact that I'd land on my feet, you know, taking the example of my father starting over repeatedly, but me well positioned because of education and so forth. I stepped out into the brave unknown, a brave new world.
And since you mentioned your father, toward the end of your opening statements in your impeachment testimony, you shared that your father was actually a Trump supporter and he tried to dissuade you from testifying. I'm curious, what exactly did your dad say to try to convince you? What was his argument?
Well, I think it's yes, he was a Trump supporter, but the basis of his counsel, which has always been really quite good and astute and rich life of lots of experience and a keen understanding of power and things of that nature. His counsel was not based on the fact that he was a Trump supporter, at least not mainly. I mean, there was probably a small component of it where he just, you know, initially didn't believe that the president had done something wrong, but he also didn't have the full situational awareness that I did. So that was easily set aside because I knew more about what was going on than he did. And he would just, you know, he would have to live with when I took my actions. But his counsel was more on the risks that he perceived to me based on the understanding of power. He grew up in World War II. He grew up under Stalin, you know, in his early years. And he understood what happens when you go up against power. And he rightly assessed that, you know, it was going to cost me my career. And I think at the time was probably a little bit idealistic, thinking that by doing the right thing, I wasn't going to be penalized by the military, but that's okay. It doesn't change my perspective on whether I did the right thing or whether doing the right thing is doing the right thing in these types of challenging situations does not come with some sort of inherent benefits or rewards. It comes with great cost. And the fact is that I could live with the consequences of my actions. I will move on. I'm going to have a second chapter and another career. And I could live with that. So I think that's really one of the most important takeaways.
You know, I have to wonder, for the average American, we've seen movies and TV versions of what it's like to testify before Congress in a high stakes proceeding like this, knowing that many on the dais will act entirely out of partisan motivations and try to impugn your credibility. But it has to be impossible for most of us to imagine that kind of pressure. Give us a sense of what it's like to actually be in the hot seat.
Well, certainly it was, it was a weighty responsibility with the eyes of America, you know, the eyes of the world on me, watching a lieutenant colonel, you know, in the subordinate of the president of the United States, the commander in chief, testifying and marveling at the fact that something like this could actually unfold, which is a testament to this country, frankly, and in the way our processes work, that the president was being held accountable for wrongdoing, you know, whether that was immediately then in impeachment and removal, or subsequently the president being revealed as corrupt and the electorate in 2020. So it's a pretty phenomenal process that played out that very few places in the world could have witnessed something similar of this nature. For me, though, I also had the perspective of serving under great pressure in Russia, where the security services, the entirety of the security apparatus, was kind of arrayed against defense attachés that they thought were, you know, in their thinking were spies and things of that nature. And I'd served in combat and, you know, I talked about the experiencing loss in the book, and within the big context of things, actually, it was a little bit, you know, there was some anxiety, but I was very, very focused on my job at that point and put everything else out to the side. And in a lot of ways, the public testimony, even though it was under the bright lights of camera, was probably less stressful than the closed door testimony because I'd never experienced anything like that before. So I had one kind of iteration under my belt when I did the public testimony. And that's why probably I came across as, you know, as unflappable.
Now, you say in the book that your military training came in pretty handy in that testimony. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, you know, there's probably a bit of lightheartedness to it. In preparation for going to Moscow, you know, you get your advanced training, individual protective measures and stuff like that. And, you know, you get some SEER training, like resisting interrogation techniques and stuff like that. And in a lot of ways, I think those congressmen were prepared to attack me, but couldn't really do that effectively on the merits, because I'm a subject matter expert on this part of the world. I could expound ad nauseum about why this region's important, what it means for national security. And they could try to do like process complaints about, you know, whether I followed chain of command, which I did, or raise all sorts of other things, you know, try to attack my character, but they couldn't really touch me on the merits. So I think in that regard, I was about as well positioned as anyone could possibly be for this kind of situation. I had the deep training in the military. You know, I was able to respond coolly under pressure. I had the deep knowledge of my region. I understood the facts in kind of the most detailed, methodical way possible. So there was nothing that those guys could do really from a merits standpoint to me, because all I had to do is tell the truth. It was really quite easy for me. I didn't have to keep a story straight. I didn't have to kind of contort myself to defend the president. It was easy in certain regards.
You know, I wonder, in putting myself in the shoes of the senators and prior to that, the congressmen who were deliberating about this, I wonder if we got too hung up on proving a quid pro quo. You know, at a certain point, it almost became Trump's defense. He kept saying there's no quid pro quo. And the standard suddenly became whether or not there was a quid pro quo, instead of, hey, a U.S. president blatantly asked a foreign power to interfere in a U.S. election and do something purely for his own personal political benefit. I mean, to me, it seems, wasn't that enough? Why did we have to focus so much on the quid pro quo?
I think that's right. I think, we intellectualized the proceedings, and maybe one of the reasons I guess my testimony was so effective is that I really kept it simple. I didn't talk about, you know, Ukrainian national security or geopolitics, which is really well within my comfort zone. Like I said, I could talk about this for days. I'm writing a book on it for my dissertation. So, I mean, I just kept it really quite simple and tried to explain to the American people that this president was attacking the Constitution. This president was attacking free and fair elections. And I think that's it. I couched it also, you know, within the personal my own personal story about the arc of my family coming to the United States as immigrants and believing this country is different and that nobody is above the law. And I think I would have to guess that that's probably one of the reasons that my testimony, you know, kind of landed the way it did.
Now, having been through the ringer and been on the receiving end of all this vitriol from the far right and Trump supporters and his allies, it's interesting. I heard that you actually reached out to Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn since he testified about the racial slurs that were hurled at him during the January 6th Capitol insurrection. What kind of advice did you give him?
Well, I gave him the same advice that I've tried to follow myself in my own experience, which is, don't listen to the vitriol. I mean, those are folks that you have, I'm sure, very little regard for attacking you. These are kind of mouthpieces, amoral individuals. You know, the stuff that's coming across on Twitter is really cowardly. I could imagine, like, you know, some little man squirreled away in the corner of the basement, you know, in mid 40s, living still in his mother's basement or something like that, you know, typing something away, making himself feel good about it. These are not people that, you know, in any way would warrant respect. I did this thing with Arnold Schwarzenegger where I went over to his house after this book talk, and he brought out the Conan sword because I called my wife a troll slayer. And so she got a chance to pose with the Conan barbarian sword. And I did the same thing and stuff like that. And then one of the attacks against me was some guy bringing out a sword, saying, "I'll go up against you with this sword. Look at me." And I'm like, what kind of person has a Conan the Barbarian sword that is not Conan? I mean, Conan is entitled to doing it. Schwarzenegger is entitled to doing it. But what other man, grown man, has a sword in his house from Conan? I mean, that just is like, come on now. Come on.
Right. And I'm sure he doesn't have combat training like you do.
I'm sure if he doesn't, or if he did, it was probably a soft skill. But, you know, I made it a point to make myself available to him and counsel him to just think about his inner circle and the support that he's getting from those folks and disregard, you know, the folks that are like would attack him on social media. But I did the same thing with Mike Fannin, who I had a chance to briefly meet, you know, in the Wolf Blitzer Situation Room, offered the same thing, pretty heroic individuals. There was a SEAL that testified against Eddie Gallagher that I've connected with, and I've had the, you know, the fortune to interact with and kind of offer some support for. And I just think there's a kind of a kinship of folks that should have been revered, I guess, for holding the line, protecting the country, living up to their oaths, but are demonized by the very folks that claim to support the military, support law enforcement. And, you know, kind of now have the blinders removed about who these people really are.
Well, before we go, I want to sort of touch on that a little bit. You famously said in your testimony, and actually it's the title of your book here, "Here Right Matters." Now, we all want to believe so, but do you still believe that right matters for many people after the Capitol insurrection, after the president's supporters and his political allies tried to undermine an election? You know, when millions of Americans refused to get a COVID vaccine or even wear a mask to protect themselves and their fellow man just because they don't feel like it. I mean, to me, it looks like a lot of people, not a few, but a lot, put their own self-interest or their political expediency far above what's right. If right doesn't matter, if it doesn't even enter into the picture for some people, where's the hope for this nation?
Well, that's very, very true. I think that for too many people, you know, their own interests exceed the interests of the community and the community, including the country itself. And I thought about this in some significant detail, as you could imagine, and I don't waver in believing that this country is unique and different from any other country in the world where you don't have the same opportunities anywhere that you do here, that you could come with nothing and end up in the White House. I also recognize that this country is a work in progress and has flaws, and that if we want right to matter here, we need to make it matter. And in part, that means shaking off complacency, that, you know, that's the complacency of, we don't need to be involved now because Biden's in power and things are going to go return back to normal. That's the complacency around, you know, using your voice when a small but extremely vocal minority attacks this country. You know, Tucker Carlson demonizes the United States and touts authoritarianism, and so do a large number of the president's circus in the GOP. A glorious party, the party of Lincoln, that's what it's become. So I think we do have some challenges to overcome, but I still have great faith in this country. We're going to get through this. We're going to come out stronger like we did after two world wars, after, you know, a massive domestic unrest in the civil rights movement, you know, another catastrophic pandemic in 1917, a civil war. I mean, all these things we've overcome. And right now we're in the fog of war, so we can't really see past our own difficulties. But I do believe we could get past them. Part of the formula is accountability. Arnold Schwarzenegger talked about unity, and we need folks like Arnold Schwarzenegger to talk about unity and the fact that we're unstoppable when we're united. But my drumbeat is on accountability.
Well, again, the book is called Here Right Matters, An American Story. Alexander Vindman, thank you for your service. Thank you for your patriotism and for coming on the show. I wish you the very best of luck, sir.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed today's episode, then subscribe and give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. Follow us on Facebook at @KickassNewsPod and email me with your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Kickass News is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com and check out some of our other shows like Food with Mark Bittman, Movie Therapy, Investing for Beginners, My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, and many others. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
An Airwave Media Podcast.